Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 1st of June, these are our main stories. As we record this podcast, a debate is taking place in the US House of Representatives on a crucial deal to increase government borrowing. The UN nuclear watchdog says it believes Iran has made further significant increases to its stockpile of enriched uranium. The BBC has been told that two Pakistani television stations have instructed staff to avoid any mention of the former Prime Minister, Imran Khan. Also in this podcast,
peas have quite a strong flavour, and particularly when used in food processing, this becomes quite intense. And I don't think anyone wants their plant-based foods to taste the peas all the time.
British scientists have managed to develop a variety of pea that has no flavour. As we record this podcast, the US House of Representatives has begun debating a bipartisan deal to raise the government's debt ceiling and avoid a damaging default. A vote is expected shortly. President Biden and the Republican Speaker, Kevin McCarthy, reached a compromise at the weekend to raise government borrowing while limiting the amount it can spend. The deal will need support from both Republicans and Democrats in the House to pass. Mr. McCarthy says he's confident it will become law. Mr. Biden has warned of the risks if it doesn't, saying that there could be a recession and millions of jobs lost. But not everyone is happy. Ralph Norman is a congressman for South Carolina who tried to stop the bill. He said the Republicans gave too much away in negotiations.
There could have been some compromise, but we'd have to get something for it. Everything we gave up, we didn't get anything in return. So I'm not saying no negotiations. I'm just saying if it's all going to be one way, then we either did a bad job negotiating or something was wrong. And as evidence with that, you will have over 100 Democrats vote for this bill because they see something they like, which they got most of what they want.
Ben Thompson spoke to the BBC's Nomia Iqbal, who was outside Capitol Hill in Washington. So would it be true to say that in general, the mood music is good at the moment?
The levels of confidence are very high. President Biden, heading to Colorado, said that he is feeling good about it. The Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, has said pretty much the same as well. And also, there's a other key figure in all of this, a man named Tom Emmer, who is the majority whip for the Republican Party. So basically, he's the guy that's going to count all the votes. 218 votes is what they need. Remember, that's the number. And he is confident that all the Republicans will get on board in the end. And he was asked, well, what about these ultra-conservatives who are saying we are not going to vote for this? There's about 30 plus of them, which could really hinder it in the House, never mind before we get to the Senate. But he believes that many of those that are making a big noise about this haven't properly read the 99-page bill. They think they are basing it on what they've heard or what they've seen on social media. And he believes, Kevin McCarthy also believes, that Republicans will get on board and pass it through the House before it then heads to the Senate.
And Nomia, while you're with us, talk to him about Mike Pence, former Vice President Mike Pence, throwing his hat, we are told, into the ring to be in the running. But it's already quite a crowded race for that Republican nomination.
It is a very crowded ring so far. And yes, he's expected to announce next Wednesday. He is actually the same day he's holding a town hall with CNN. He's expected to launch a video in Iowa. Iowa is an early voting state, very important because he wants to shore up those voters, those evangelical voters that will be very crucial for him. But yes, his announcement comes shortly after Ron DeSantis announced, Tim Scott as well. And he's not going to be the last. We do expect other Republican candidates to throw their hat in the ring as well.
That was Nomia Iqbal in Washington. The International Atomic Energy Agency estimates that Iran has increased its stockpile of enriched uranium by about a ton since February. The IAEA said the total stockpile was now over 23 times the limit set out in the 2015 accord between Tehran and world powers. Bethany Bell reports from Vienna.
The IAEA said Iran's decision to stop implementing its commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal has seriously affected its ability to track Iran's nuclear program. But it said it has been able to restore some monitoring equipment at two sites at Fordo and Natanz and surveillance cameras at workshops in Isfahan. The agency said Iran continues to enrich uranium in breach of the limits set up under the nuclear deal. It estimates that Iran's stockpile includes 114 kilos of uranium enriched to 60%, close to weapons-grade purity.
Bethany Bell. Since Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February of last year, millions of people have either fled the country or moved from some of the areas worst affected by the Russian bombardments. Now, though, there is the start of, albeit a far more limited, upheaval of people in Western Russia. The governor of Russia's Belgorod region, bordering Ukraine, has announced the evacuation of 300 children as cross-border attacks increase. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov expressed Moscow's worries.
We are concerned about this situation. The shelling of civilian facilities continues there. By the way, we haven't heard a word of condemnation from any of the countries of the collective West. The situation there is quite alarming. Measures are being taken.
I got more from Katerina Kinkulova from the BBC Russian service, and she started by telling me about the comments by the mayor of Belgorod.
The way he phrased it, that this is the first group, implying that there'll be later more children going further north into Russia. And the thinking behind this, according to him, is that it's too dangerous that now these cross-border attacks, of which the Russian authorities are accusing Ukraine, they just make it too dangerous. In the latest attack, overnight, Tuesday to Wednesday, four people were injured, so no one was killed, but four people were injured and several buildings were damaged. This is sort of incomparable to what's happening in Ukraine. On the other hand, it is having an effect, and it's having a psychological effect on civilians inside Russia, and they're sort of starting to get just greater understanding of how this can very realistically affect their life.
And Katerina, this comes at a time when we've seen drone attacks, we don't know exactly from where, but drone attacks arriving in some Moscow suburbs this week. What's the public mood across Russia now? Is it possible to gauge from social media whether or not this is boosting support for President Putin or diminishing it?
Well, it's an interesting combination of both. So on the one hand, it's boosting support amongst those who probably supported this war, this special military operation, as it's called in Russia in the first place. But it's also, there's a growing sense of anxiety because this military action, as it were, is coming closer to home. And it's having this psychological effect, which is possibly what Ukraine, if Ukraine indeed is behind these drone attacks, would possibly hope for, is this distraction from what's happening on the front line, and sort of make Russia spread its resources to make it stretch further. So in general, when we look at this war and we look at how it's panned out until now, it's all been all about not what you expect, not what you think. So, you know, when it first started, we were thinking that Russia was going to take over Kyiv in a matter of days and Zelensky would run away from Ukraine and, you know, be in exile, president in exile somewhere. In actual fact, it's completely different. And then in recent days, we've had this weeks and months, we've had this talk of Ukrainian counteroffensive that should start any moment. Ukraine is under pressure to start this counteroffensive. On the other hand, even with all the resources and with all the assistance it's getting from the West, it still is not as strong as Russia, and its resources are limited.
As Katerina Kinkulova. Meanwhile, the former commander of international forces in Afghanistan and Iraq says that Ukraine is ready to launch that counteroffensive. Having met President Zelensky on Tuesday, General David Petraeus told the BBC's correspondent in Kyiv, James Landell, that he was confident Ukraine's impressive, in his words, army would be able to break through Russian lines.
I believe that we'll see for the first time in this war on either side the achievement of true combined arms effects. In other words, the results of tanks protected by infantry against anti-tank guided missiles, artillery and mortars keeping the enemy's heads down, engineers reducing the obstacles, breaching these fortifications that the Russians have established, air defense keeping the Russians off the Ukrainians, electronic warfare jamming the Russians' already inadequate command and control facilities, all orchestrated by very, very good Ukrainian command and control And also using drones out over the Russians to attack them in depth with the precision munitions that the U.S. and U.K. and others have provided. And the difference this time over, say, what happened in Kharkiv last fall, where the Ukrainians did carry out a very successful attack, is that when the lead elements culminate after 72, 96 hours, it's as far as you can physically go, there are follow-on forces that will capitalize, that will exploit and maintain the momentum and continue this. And then I think you get the battlefield, you make it dynamic. Then the Russians have to react. They have to move to try to reestablish a defensive line somewhere in the rear of where they are and where they were. And noting that on the Russian side, this is a force that has been battered, that many of these units have been in constant combat for well over a year. And I think, therefore, that's why they're going to crack, crumble, and perhaps actually collapse.
That was General David Petraeus. The museum at the former German Auschwitz camp has criticised Poland's governing party for using images of the camp to discredit the opposition. The museum said the political campaign video insulted the memory of the camp's victims. During the Second World War, more than a million Jewish people were killed at Auschwitz by the Nazi regime. Adam Easton reports from Warsaw.
The governing Law and Justice Party's Twitter video used images of Auschwitz to tarnish a prominent opposition-supporting journalist who called for the party's leader, as well as the country's president, to be sent to a chamber for what he called their crimes against democracy. In Polish, the word chamber is often associated with the Nazi gas chambers. The journalist has apologised. He said he meant sending the politicians to jail, not to a gas chamber.
That was Adam Easton in Poland. Since seizing power in a coup more than 2 years ago, the military in Myanmar has become increasingly isolated by Western sanctions, but not completely. Russia has moved in to fill the vacuum, becoming the junta's biggest foreign backer, despite evidence of widespread human rights abuses. According to the latest United Nations report, more than $400 million worth of arms have been shipped from Russia to the Myanmar regime since the coup. The BBC's Asia editor, Rebecca Henschke, reports.
Children at a primary school hide under their desks as the sound of fighter jets fills the air. Duck down, someone shouts. When they think it's safe, they run. But the Myanmar military's jet circles back. While crouching in a rubbish ditch just next to the toilet, the children start to pray. God will save you. Don't worry. You can say your prayers louder, one of the adults with them says. They're safe this time. But airstrikes by the military are now a daily occurrence for the people of Myanmar. Monasteries, hospitals, churches and schools have been hit. The deadliest in April, killing more than 170 people, including many women and children. Struggling on the ground to suppress an armed pro-democracy uprising, the military has taken this fight against their own people to the air. Leonie Hardevi is a senior investigator with the group Myanmar Witness that is monitoring the conflict.
The Myanmar military is increasingly relying on its air power because the resistance forces on the ground have been effective.
The junta is increasingly isolated by Western sanctions, but Russia has stepped up to become their strongest foreign backer and biggest arms dealer.
Not only the support has not decreased, Russian representatives have made very clear that despite the coup of 2021, they would continue to provide the Myanmar military with Air Force assets.
Captain Zay Tu Ang was in the Air Force for 18 years.
Most of my friends keep fighting. Just my Myanmar people.
The devastating impact of the junta's war in the air is clear at a safe house for injured resistance fighters on the Thai border.
Every available space is being used for the injured. Most of them have either lost a leg or an arm. Some have bandages on their eyes. In one of the beds is a 22-year-old fighter who before the coup wanted to set up a coffee shop. He's been paralysed from the waist down and has lost an arm in an air bombing. His mother is with him and she's sitting closely, moving his legs when he requests it, or getting him food, or passing him his mobile phone. I look over at his mum. How did she react when she got the news, I ask. He smiles at her.
Mum said many things. She told me to continue fighting with my remaining arm. I must fight on for freedom. Freedom for me personally and our people. Not only for the people, also for my comrade brothers and for those who fell before my eyes. In summary, I'm fighting for democracy.
It's very hard to see these young men talk about the future that they wanted and then them to see them here so badly injured.
That report by Rebecca Henschke. Still to come.
When a woman has been socialised into, I don't want to use the word oppressed, right? That doesn't mean that, you know, that's all there is to her.
One of Africa's most celebrated authors and playwrights, Ghanaian Ama Atta Eidu, has died aged 81.
Hi, I'm Izzy Greenfield from Business Daily. We bring you important and interesting stories from the world of money and work. And we've been taking a deep dive into the music industry. It's worth $26 billion a year globally. And I've spoken to industry experts from around the world, from international pop stars and gospel groups to aspiring local artists, to find out what it takes to make it in such a lucrative but exclusive industry. That's Business Daily from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Five members of a Palestinian militant group have been killed in an explosion near Lebanon's border with Syria. Local media reports say that Israel was behind the blast. Here's Tom Bateman.
Pictures from the blast site show a building in ruins, with wreckage filling its foundations. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine General Command has blamed Israel, saying five members, including two senior figures, were killed in an airstrike. But an Israeli source told the BBC its military was not involved, while Lebanese security sources claim it was caused by munitions being moved around. It comes in one of the region's most sensitive border areas, as tensions and heated rhetoric have been growing between Israel and militants in Lebanon and Syria who are backed by Iran.
Tom Bateman. Sources at two different Pakistani television outlets have told the BBC that they've been instructed by the authorities not to mention the name of the former Prime Minister, Imran Khan. Caroline Davies reports from Islamabad.
No pictures, no name, no clips, not even a ticker tape, is how one source described the ban on Imran Khan on Pakistan TV. The two sources that spoke to the BBC said that the message that they were not to mention the former Prime Minister did not come through a formal diktat from the country's media regulator, but through messages passed down by senior management. The BBC did not receive a response from the government or from the media regulator. It appears this is just the latest attempt by the Pakistan authorities to isolate Mr. Khan. Thousands of supporters are still in police custody, and the army has said that it intends to try some in military courts for their alleged involvement in attacks on military buildings, which happened after Mr. Khan was arrested on the 9th of May.
Caroline Davies in Pakistan. One of Africa's most celebrated authors and playwrights, the Ghanaian Ama Atta Eidu, has died aged 81. A renowned feminist, she depicted and celebrated the condition of African women in works like The Dilemma of a Ghost, Our Sister Killjoy and Changes. She opposed what she described as a Western perception that the African female is a downtrodden wretch. In 2014, Zena Badawi spoke to her and asked her about her perspective on women, men and feminism in Africa.
My point is that when a woman has been socialized into, I don't want to use the word oppressed, right? But when a woman has been put under pressure, when she's been socialized into a certain space and she is being that woman in that space, that doesn't mean that, you know, that's all there is to her. My problem with seeing African women, you know, the quintessentially world oppressed and so on and so forth, is that it removes any agency from African women, as if we are just there, you know, to be oppressed, to make babies.
So you have said that you're very averse to this Western perception that the African
world
female...
World
perception that the African female,
yes,
is a downtrodden wretch. You're also seen as the, perhaps, paramount African feminist. Do you describe yourself as a feminist?
I am a feminist, yeah.
And you don't think that's a bit of a loaded term that's associated with the 1970s women's liberation movement, women burning their bras in Western capitals?
So what if they were burning their bras? I mean, the feminists, if you say that, you know, a feminist is just somebody, not necessarily a woman, who believes in the potential of women to get to the highest possible level of development, you know, given the facilities a society makes available. I mean, just as any man. And being a feminist is not necessarily being a woman feminist.
Well, Peter Akwoche heard more about Ama-Ata Edu from Professor Kwabena Opoku-Agyemang, who's a lecturer in the Department of English at the University of Ghana.
It's a huge loss. Ama-Ata Edu was an icon and an inspiration to generations of people generally from all over the world. There are multiple testimonies of how impactful her work was, not just her writing, but her life in general. So her leaving is a huge void that is not just nation size or continent size. It's a global, the world has lost a global icon.
And you mentioned the impact her writing had. I mean, could just give us a few examples of why her works stood out so much.
She stood out for different reasons. One of the major reasons was that she represented a generation of African women writers who charted a path that set the foundation for current superstars in the field like Chimamanda Adichie and so on and so forth. She, for example, went to school at a time when it was taboo for girls to be formally educated in her village. And that single act sparked a trend that made it more normalized for girls to go to school, for instance, and to get formal education. And that kind of trailblazing attitude characterized her life up into her writing. So when she wrote different works, she was able to tackle themes that hitherto were not really talked about in mainstream circles. And that set the path for subsequent generations of women writers to also do what they are doing today.
Yeah, indeed, because when she started writing, I mean, it was still a novelty to have women at the center of African prose in terms of character development and all that. And she was quite a crusader as well, wasn't she, for women's rights, for Africa as a whole, always defending Africa and African identity.
Yes, she was an activist. She was unashamed about it, and she was very proud of her defense of Africa. Yes, she was a big campaigner for women's rights and for African rights and for minorities' rights in general. She was very interested in portraying women's agency. She didn't like that idea, which is very Western-centric, of the poor, frail, weak African woman. So she gave her characters a lot of agency, and she made sure that her characters were very strong.
Professor Kwabena Opoku-Agyemang from the University of Ghana. Now to a story of some taxi drivers who were getting paid for having their meters turned off. Well, nearly 3,000 taxi drivers in Israel are being compensated now by their app-based company because the firm offered a service for devout Jewish customers that excluded the Sabbath from sunset on Friday to sunset on Saturday. For Arab drivers, this meant a loss of income, and now the company has agreed that wasn't fair. Our Middle East regional editor, Mike Thompson, reports.
Since 2015, the Get taxi firm had been running a special service for devout Jewish customers called Mehadrin. a Hebrew word referencing the most stringent level of kosher supervision. This guaranteed that anyone who drove them had to have committed to not working on Shabbat, the Jewish day of rest, which runs from sunset on Friday to sunset on Saturday. The idea was, the company said, to satisfy their customers' religious preference not to encourage fellow Jews to work on that day. So, what could be wrong with that? Well, quite a lot in the opinion of lawyers acting for the Israel Religious Action Centre, the legal arm of the Israel Movement for Reform and Progressive Judaism. They successfully argued that the service discriminated against Arab and other non-Jewish drivers who had no religious obligation to not work on that day, yet because they did so, would be excluded from offering their service to Mehedrin customers. Gett finally agreed to sign a settlement, ending the protracted class action suit against it. The company's Mehedrin service has now been scrapped, and close to 3,000 drivers are to be compensated with sums of up to $4,300 each.
Mike Thompson. Now, how do you feel about the taste of peas? Do you hate it, or do you ask for more? Well, if you're not a fan, you could be in luck, because British scientists have managed to develop a variety of pea that has no flavour. But it's not just about the taste. They're hoping to produce an environmentally friendly alternative to soya, to meet the growing demand for plant-based protein. Paul Billings is the director of Germinal, a Belfast-based plant breeding firm, one of the companies behind the project, and he told us more about the benefits.
In the UK, we have a pretty much unsustainable soya habit, one that I believe we should break. So we import about 3 million tonnes of soya beans into the UK for use in animal and human feedstuffs a year. And we don't really have a solution for that at the current time, and demand for plant-based proteins is increasing as we change diets. We can't grow soya beans in this country due to our climate, but peas do grow very well in this country and are suited to our climate. They're also very environmentally friendly. However, as with all things, there is a bit of a drawback. Peas have quite a strong flavour, and particularly when used in food processing, this becomes quite intense. And I don't think anyone wants their plant-based foods to taste the peas all the time. Okay. So that's why we're trying to get rid of the flavour. If you do like peas, don't worry, because we're not producing the peas that sit on your plate next to your fish and chips. So what we are producing more is a food ingredient. So they'll be used by food manufacturers to produce plant-based meat substitute foods. Your sausages, your burgers, plant-based pies, that type of food. We all know that some of the soya grown in South America follows deforestation, which carries a very heavy environmental footprint as well. And so, yeah, we have no air miles. We have it fixing its own fertilizer from the air, leaving some in the ground for the next crop. It really is a good environmental crop to be growing.
Paul Billings. Now, do you fancy living in a castle? Such a building on a remote Scottish island can actually be yours for only $37,000. Or the catch is that you'll need more than £12 million, or nearly $15 million, to renovate it. Brough Lodge is on the Isle of Fetla, where only 61 people live. The current owner is the Brough Lodge Trust, and they've been looking for someone who can love and care for this 200-year-old property. Davina Gupta spoke to the Trust treasurer, Drew Ratter, and asked him why he was selling the castle for such a small amount.
That's basically a token figure. What we're really looking for is people who will take this on and do a good job afterwards. So we've had quite a lot of interest, some of it very constructive and useful. In fact, we're in negotiation with somebody, and some of it, shall I say, perhaps less credible.
And what is the price of renovation? Because the figures may vary. Some are even saying that the end cost could be as high as $12 million.
That's pounds, but yes, it's quite probable. It's a very large and complex building by our standards. It's had about £500,000 spent on it already, renewing the roof and stabilising the whole building. So it's in decent structural condition. But to turn it into the kind of retreat that would be our ambition to see will cost at least 10, probably £12 million.
So the end price for this castle What would it be with the bids going on? As you said, the queries have come in.
Well, basically what we're doing is we've been involved in this trust for some time. We're all in our early 70s, three of us who are heavily engaged, and we don't think that we can take it further. It needs to be somebody with access to significant capital and vision who will be there to take it further.
That was Drew Ratter from the Brough Lodge Trust on the Shetland Islands. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later on. Before we go, here's Jackie Leonard.
Some good news for anyone who wants a bit more positivity in their lives. The Happy Pod is going to be a regular thing, an upbeat little addition to the Global News podcast feed, featuring nothing but the uplifting, inspiring, or amusing. The first in the new series will be on June the 10th, and if you want to get involved, send us audio of the thing that brings you joy. The usual address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk.
And if you want to comment on this podcast, you can use the same email. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Hansen. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, bye-bye.